Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is Gavin McLaughlin with you on News Talk's Taking Stock, and we're joined now by Ray Griffin, lecturer in strategic management at Waterford Institute of Technology and co-author of The Reformation of Welfare, The New Faith of the Labour Market. Ray, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a million for having me.
Your argument is that the Catholic Church may have diminished in influence, but it may have been replaced by a new church.
Yeah, the Church of Work, almost.
And what is it that makes you say work is like a church?
Well, I suppose the outsized role that work has in most people's lives. Like if I ask my MBA students, as I commonly do, you know, do they miss family events because of work? Do they feel work is damaging their health and well-being? You know, do they work too much? Most of them nod, and they have lots of war stories to tell. You know, the 40-hour working week was developed by Henry Ford almost a century ago. And since then, the kind of progress in working less and, you know, having more higher quality lives seems to have gotten away from us a little bit.
Yeah, well, I was only reading during the week about a crew of junior bankers at Goldman Sachs who were kind of complaining to the management there that they were working 95-hour weeks and they were kind of looking for a pay rise. And it kind of sparked a big argument within management at Goldman Sachs, and some of them were of the view, look, if we give these people what they're looking for, you know, it would set a dangerous precedent. You know, we'd be creating a higher fixed cost base for ourselves and we'd be getting away from our principle of that we'd pay for performance. So they'd give them a big bonus if they felt they deserved it. But otherwise, you know, you're kind of at a lower level of fixed pay. So, I mean, this kind of debate about, you know, the 40-hour week and how much we should be working and how much we shouldn't be, it's really kind of taken off, I'd say, since the pandemic hit, really.
Absolutely. Like, you wonder what kind of decision a banker is making in his 96th hour of work during a week. You know, we don't let pilots or truck drivers or really important people do that type of work. Like, the reason Henry Ford introduced the 40-hour working week was because there was a huge drop in productivity if you made people work longer hours. So it was an economic efficiency argument to have the 40-hour working week. What's amazing about the pandemic is, like, in the space of a week, we sent almost half our workforce home. Like, 1 million people were prevented from working. And it hadn't a huge implication for GDP, and it hadn't a huge implication for supply chains. Life continued. Okay, it was disrupted. It was probably not how you'd do it. But it is a wake-up call to how kind of like outrageously oversized the concept of work has become in most people's lives.
Let's take the religion analogy a little bit further. You say in this new Church of Work, there's an equivalent of purgatory.
Yeah. So most of my research in Waterford is on the experience of unemployment. So I'm running a European project that is developing digital welfare systems, you know, at a kind of enterprise level for European governments. And so we spend a lot of time interviewing unemployed people, and their description of the time unemployed is as this enormous burden where they're kind of stuck and lost and searching. It's this kind of lost in the experience of it. And a lot of what is happening in their lives evaporates, the meaning of it evaporates. So like a lot of them talk about, you know, doing caring work, which is totally outside the economy. But that doesn't have the meaning. So looking after your kids while you're unemployed feels like, you know, just that things aren't going well. It's the wrong thing to
do. Yeah, and it's, there's a sense of shame, I think, that people feel about it, which again, I would say is analogous to Catholic Ireland.
Well, I think it's, the shame thing is an interesting thing because you hear Tommy Tiernan's description of the long weekend of the 1980s, like his experience in Galway being unemployed, which is kind of a frothy, happy, unstigmatized version of being unemployed. There was no work. Our chaotic country had run aground again. But then are also the other kind of stories we have from the 1980s, like Paddy O'Gorman's like incredibly revealing interviews on, you know, queuing for a living and stuff like that. The key thing then was there was no institutional stigma. about unemployment.
What do you mean by institutional stigma?
Well, the system of unemployment wasn't actively trying to make people feel bad about their condition. Like, there was an understanding at the time that the reason why people were unemployed is we'd mucked up the country. And it wasn't anybody's fault. It just happened. And certainly the people who are unemployed should be pitied for the situation they're in. And they really had a choice of migrating or staying with their people. If they migrated to London or New York, they'd get work. If they stayed, it was a sentence of unemployment. And so there was no moralising when you went into the dole office. You just were given your money, you know, and sent on your way. And they weren't trying to reform you. There's a non-Catholic, a real European tradition, which comes from the Calvinist faith, the Scandinavians, which we kind of import their policies wholesale here. And that is about fixing up people and saving
themselves. And you would argue that we've gotten away from this model that we have in the 80s, more towards this argument where we feel, you know, if you're unemployed, you're sort of a recalcitrant who needs to be sorted out.
Well, there's a bizarre second act in this reform, which is we were being reformed as a country by the Troika that brought in this type of approach to welfare in the conditions of the global financial crisis.
Well, let's just dig into it for a second. I mean, what precisely do you mean? What particular aspects of the current system are representative of this approach you're talking about?
I suppose the idea that the government can fix people and change them and make them ready for work. So if you're unemployed today, and a lot of people won't know this because this is an experience many people have during their life, but only in specific times. About half the people in the labour market are unemployed at one stage or another. But if you go into the Intreo offices now, you know, there's mentoring, there's workshops, there's confidence training. And it's not particularly aggressive in Ireland, but across Europe, it's much more significant, in which they kind of work people over to develop employability skills. Now, the two kind of things about that is, firstly, these don't really work. So the government can't really fix people up with these kind of short-term inventions. The evidence of those policy interventions is that they don't work. They're also incredibly expensive to deliver. And yet we're moving more towards these kind of systems of administering the experience of unemployment.
Well, look at what's going on now. I mean, we're speaking just after the summer economic statement has been published, and there's sort of an acknowledgement that a lot of businesses aren't going to survive this pandemic, and there's a lot of people who are going to need to be retrained. So there's going to be even more of this now.
Well, that is kind of the assumption of this, and yet the OECD predicts we'll be back to pre-COVID unemployment rates in 2 years. Like, the interesting thing is, like, Ireland is a work cult. I have yet to interview somebody who does not want to work. And I've in my research team, we've interviewed over 150 people.
Well, that is 150. I mean, it's a lot of people, but it's still anecdotal, really. I mean, how measurable is this phenomenon, that assertion that Ireland is a war cult and that it's like a religion? Is it something that you can really measure with hard data?
I suppose there are hard data approaches. I would argue that qualitative data is hard data and should be feed into our policy system. So
you mean that these 150 interviews you're talking about?
Yeah. And the other type of work we do in studying policy evaluations and parliamentary testimony. We've done research studying media discourses on unemployment. You know, so across those methods, I suppose this message bubbles out.
Is this sort of a uniquely Irish thing, or is it the same in other places as well?
Actually, we're not as far along on this journey. If you go to Denmark, Finland, Sweden, Austria, there are other countries. The United Kingdom is incredibly harsh on this. And all of this is underwritten by conditionality, which is the threat over and over again that if you don't do these specific actions, you will lose your payments. Like, the Irish system is still quite humane and gracious compared to those other systems. But the risk is that as we go down this kind of policy homogenisation approach, we become more like these European countries.
Well, a lot of people would say that's fair enough, though. They'd say, you know, some people might even say, put unemployed people to work, have them sweep the streets or, you know, I don't know, clip the hedges or things like that. A lot of people have that opinion.
Oh, and like that, you know, that opinion comes from the Bible. You know, he who doesn't work shall not eat. It was St. Paul. You know, but bear in mind, it's not a utilitarian argument. So it's not as though that works. So what it is about reforming people to save their souls. That if somebody isn't working, in some way, they're kind of misdirected in life. So work is the end, not the means.
So you're taking the utilitarian approach kind of in terms of what you think we should do, that what we should be focusing on is making the greatest number of people happy.
Absolutely. Is that not what our government has signed up to into the programme for government? And bear in mind, like we've learned that there's a small number of people need to work in this country to keep the show on the road at the standard we are accustomed to. So, and I'm not...
Why do you say that?
Well, I suppose the COVID demonstrated that.
That we had a huge rise in unemployment and yet the tax base held up very, very strongly.
Our economy held up very strongly. Services held up very strongly and supply chains held up very strongly. So it is a policy choice. I'm not calling for radical reform here, but certainly the idea of a four-day working week is definitely something to put on the table. Ireland has amongst the lowest number of bank holidays of any European state. So most European states have 11 bank holidays, we have 9. People have every now and then thrown that out as something we should have to take pressures off family, you know, add to quality of life, give people more time to restore and fill their batteries.
Our guest here on News Talk is Ray Griffin, lecturer in strategic management at Waterford Institute of Technology and co-author of The Reformation of Welfare, The New Faith of the Labour Market. There's loads of different threads to this. I want to go back to the point about the tax base, though, for a second. I mean, certainly it is true that the tax base has held up very, very well, but obviously we've got this corporation tax reform that's going on at the moment, that's going to take at least $2 billion a year of that revenue away. And the other thing, which is mentioned in the summer economic statement that jumps out at me in this regard, is the problem of our ageing population. So that's going to put huge fiscal pressure on us in the years ahead. So your argument that actually we don't need that many people to keep the show on the road, these two factors may undermine that, you know, in the next decades.
Well, and that's why a historical diagnosis is so important, because what you rolled out there was a Malthusian, Ricardian economics.
Oh, hang on a second now. Hang on a second. You got to explain that to me.
So at the start of economics, after Adam Smith came along, these kind of quite austere Scottish Presbyterians who, you know, their religious values infused their economics and that idea that people needed to work. It was actually that logic that led to the famine. It was Malthus was the main educator of colonial leaders. And the idea is that, well, you know, the famine was a kind of probably a very sketched version of it, but that it was, you know, the just desserts coming home. That's also kind of part of the American Protestant culture, where the rich are rich because they're favored by God. So it does come from that religious tradition. The tradition we have comes from a Keynesian tradition, where unemployment is a problem of industry, it's a problem of the government, it's not an individual person's fault. And as a result of that, care for the individual through this difficult stage becomes the policy priority. And that's, I think, where Irish values traditionally were. So our approach is very, very much fused by a belief in work for its own sake rather than the necessity of it. And certainly the idea that we can't afford our old people is insane. There's 6% of Irish people work in agriculture, and we feed way more than Ireland with that. So it's a matter of organisation and how we develop a social compact. We've got to go back to the principles of why do we have these complicated social welfare systems. A lot of people don't think about that much. They just kind of tinker away at them. But the main reason to have a social welfare system is that it protects capitalism. Our system of the economy produces, you know, incredible goods and materials and wealth and prosperity and well-being for people. But its Achilles heel is in inequality. And that inequality bubbles over typically as violence. The Gilets jaunes in France, rioting in the United Kingdom, even the Irish water fights, kind of conflict that bubbled away there. So the pressure release valve for capitalism is the social welfare system, which is our social compact. And if we misjudge that by making social welfare, you know, overly harsh, we put that peacefulness at risk.
You mentioned the four-day week there a little bit earlier. I mean, it does sound great. I can understand all that, but I think there need to be other reforms to go with it, because I think in a lot of cases when people move to a 4-day week, they find they're just sort of cramming 5 days work into four.
Absolutely. And well, there's a lot of anthropological work on what people do at work. Like sometimes, you know, I rush into WIT, drop the kids, you know, like it's all drama. I arrive in and my first job involves sitting, talking to somebody, having a cup of coffee, and just that's almost relaxing. And then there's intense parts during the day. So a lot of people waste a lot of time at work faffing around. David Graeber, the late anthropologist, had his thesis of bullshit jobs, in which he suggested that more than half of the jobs that people have, most people couldn't explain them to a child. Like it wasn't actually work. It was, you know, brand manager for Biscuit Experience or something like that. They're going to a conference in Frankfurt about the future of biscuits or something. It seems very far from actually making biscuits.
Hmm. I am interested in the future of biscuits now that you mentioned. You kind of make me hungry. What reforms do you want?
I suppose I'm not looking for reform. I would like people who are running our system to understand the deep cultural codes within it so that they make better decisions. I think a lot of people who tinker around in welfare systems don't understand its role in producing peace and harmony and how brittle that accomplishment is in Europe and how rare it is over the last 70, 80 years. So when people kind of moralise that, oh, you know, lazy scroungers, good for nothing, so they should get on their bike and do work, I think most people don't realise that they're articulating, you know, quite a medieval religious view that almost has no place in our complicated society today.
I would say that's quite an extreme argument. I think a lot of people might say, look, you know, obviously there's taxpayers' money that's being given to unemployed people, etc., etc., and, you know, we need to manage taxpayers' money quite carefully. It is quite reasonable, some would say, to argue that if you're going to give taxpayers' money to an individual, you know, you insist that they do certain things.
I suppose within its... There's many reasons why we can't do this. The first one is climate. We can't sustain this level of material production and human movement. We have to negotiate to post-growth decarbonisation. And one of the ways we have to do that is get off the kind of religious cult that is work. The labour movement want higher quality work and more time off. One of the hidden transformations is that caring work is increasingly being sucked into the commercial economy. Now, there's a gender prism for all that obviously is a strong reason why that needs to happen in a certain way, but it could be done differently. So how do we look after older people, nursing homes? How do we look after our children, creches? So caring gets squeezed, and it's as though that doesn't exist in our lives. Like, the number one ambition of the European Union's social programme is to get 78% labour market participation of the ages between the ages of 18 and 65. Irish labour market participation rates are around 60%. So it's government policy that more people have to be dragged into the labour market.
And who should pay for the people who aren't participating? You're going to accuse me of being medieval and religious here, but I'm just giving you a hypothetical. If somebody decides, you know what, I just don't want to work, I don't fancy it, what should happen? Should they be getting welfare payments?
Well, that's the argument of universal basic income people, and that is part of government policy. The surprising thing is very few people, I don't know who these people are. They're a mythical other people. I certainly have never encountered them in my life. You know, when somebody is left to their own devices, they volunteer in a GAA club, they grow vegetables, they do the tidy towns, they get a dog and walk it. You know, they fill their life full of meaningful things. And, you know, it's almost as though you can't conceive of life beyond work by asking that question.
Well, Ray, that's all we have time for. It's been fascinating. Thanks very much for coming in. That's Ray Griffin, lecturer in strategic management at Waterford Institute of Technology and co-author of The Reformation of Welfare, The New Faith of the Labour Market. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Taking stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.